This is the takeaway for Thursday, July 7th, 2016.
He just shot his arm off. We got pulled over on Larpiner.
I told him not to reach for it. I told him to get his hand off it.
You told him to get his ID, sir, and his driver's license. Oh my God, please don't tell me he's dead. Please don't tell me my boyfriend just went like that.
Just keep your hands where they are, please.
Yes, I will, sir. I'll keep my hands where they are. Please don't tell me this, Lord. Please, Jesus, don't tell me that he's gone.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. That calm voice there in a moment of terror that you're listening to belongs to Lavish Reynolds. She was on her cell phone broadcasting that scene live on Facebook last night, moments after her boyfriend was killed by a police officer. Philandro Castile was pulled over by police when his girlfriend says he was reaching for his wallet to show the officer the concealed carry permit he said he had for the gun that he also said he had. The officer fired into Castile's arm, and Lavish Reynolds captured what you just heard, the entire aftermath, on her phone. Philandro Castile died from those gunshot wounds. This is the second video of controversial police shootings in less than 48 hours. In Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Alton Sterling was shot and killed by police in a convenience store parking lot. They were holding him down and claimed that he had a weapon. Demonstrators turned out both in Louisiana and in Minnesota.
If you need a hand, we all need somebody to lean on.
That crowd moved from the scene of the shooting to the governor's mansion, where they lit candles and sang for Philandro and the numerous other victims of police shootings throughout the country. The federal government does not have an accurate database of police shootings, but the Washington Post does, and their tally, as of today, 509 fatal shootings by police officers in the line of duty in 2015, including Alton Sterling and Philandro Castile. The editor and publisher of the Reno News and Review in Nevada has been working on a similar database since 2012. Fatal Encounters was the first national database of its kind that tracked police killings. The Washington Post won a Pulitzer Prize for its database modeled after that grassroots effort in Nevada. Stephen Rich is the database editor for investigations at the Washington Post, and he joins me now. Stephen, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've reviewed these last two shootings in the last 48 hours, which are just the latest in the long series of cases that you've been documenting, up to 506 now. What do the numbers, apart from and including these last two cases that the country is going to be talking about now, what do the numbers say? How have the patterns changed in these high-profile shootings since they became the attention of politicians and the media and the general public?
The numbers really haven't changed on a lot of fronts. The majority of victims are still white people, but black people are killed at a rate of about 2.5 times that of white people. One of the major changes, though, that we have been seeing is the presence of videos is more and more, it's there more often now. We've seen almost as many body camera videos in shootings this year as all of last year combined. So we're starting to see that videos are more present at these scenes, and we're starting to get a little better of an accounting of what happened with these videos, even though in many cases we as the public never get to see these videos.
Of the details of the shooting, and are most of those videos coming from police officer body cameras that are spreading or from bystander smartphones?
It's a little bit of both. We're seeing a lot of the rise in the body cameras. More and more police departments are adopting it, and as a result, we're seeing more and more police officers who are wearing those body cameras during the shootings.
And yet, the promise or the initial promise or part of it of the spread of body cameras, apart from accountability and after-action review, was supposed to be some kind of proactive accountability, right? That if you're wearing a body camera as a police officer, you're going to, I dare say, behave in a more inhibited fashion, or maybe for people who think that police are acting irresponsibly, the body camera will mean that you're not going to make any rash decisions as a cop. But you're saying the numbers don't reflect that yet.
Right. That was the theory. We expected that more body cameras meant potentially less shootings, but in the moment, that's not what's happening. It's just meaning that there are more fatal shootings that have body camera video. And so it's unclear as to whether what that will look like long term, but in the interim, it's not meant a decrease in shootings.
Where are the shootings happening, Stephen Rich, by and large? Like if you paint a picture of where police killing of a suspect happens, where is that place?
Everywhere. There is not a place in this country that hasn't had a police shooting this year. Last year, Rhode Island was the only state that did not have a fatal police shooting. This year, every single state has one through the first 6 months. And so we're seeing them a lot in rural, in urban, in everywhere that you can possibly think of. Police shootings doesn't have a typical place, and it doesn't have an atypical place.
We talked about some of the raw numbers, which you say have not changed since reform became part of the national conversation through all of the well-covered police shootings. What about the details of the cases, the way they go down, whether it's guns or drugs at the heart of it, the race of the cop, the race of the person who shot? Are any of those details changing in a way that you can discern?
Not very much. I mean, the number of unarmed is about the same as what we're normally seeing. The rate of black people being killed is about the same. Realistically, the only shift that we've seen is there's about a 5% uptick in shootings through the first 6 months of this year. How that will play out over the last 6 months is to be seen, but we have seen a little bit of an increase.
Well, Stephen Rich, you're a data guy, clearly, there at the Washington Post, and I know you like to look at sort of the matrix wave of numbers that come down. And from your perspective, what are you looking for as reform efforts start to happen in jurisdictions across the country, whether it's body cameras or another kind of reform? People will always get killed by police. That's inevitable, and many of those killings will be justified. But as a data guy, what will spell success for you here?
We're looking mostly at what kind of reforms are being put in place in individual police departments and how they may take effect. One of the things that we're seeing and that we've seen by studying this over the past four decades or so is that change doesn't happen overnight. And so we don't necessarily expect these police departments that put in reforms to have a sudden shift in the number of police shootings. We've seen it with the NYPD years ago instituted a change not to shoot into moving cars. And now their numbers are greatly down from what they used to be, but it took a while. And so we are looking at the long view of this and trying to see what has potentially made the number of police shootings in certain jurisdictions go down.
Stephen Rich is database editor for investigations at The Washington Post, and he's been tracking these numbers. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
You can visit the Washington Post's website depicting this data-driven look at the 509 police shootings in the United States to date. It's called Fatal Force. And when you go there, you'll get a sense of how each statistic, each incident in the Washington Post investigation boils down to a real person and a real life. Across the country, police officers arrest more than 1.2 million people on drug charges, illegal drug charges, possession every year. A lot of times, those cops use roadside drug tests that cost just $2 each to determine the substance at hand, maybe in the back of a car or in someone's pocket. Drop a little bit of the suspect substance into a test tube, shake it up, watch to see if the color turns from pink to blue. And if it does, that's cocaine or heroin or some other contraband substance that's illegal. And there you go. Enough for an arrest. That person's going to jail that night. But a new investigation from ProPublica and the New York Times Magazine finds that these very tests may be highly unreliable. And that means that every year, tens of thousands of people are sent to jail based on, at least in part, false positive roadside drug tests. And a majority of those cases can lead to felony convictions to stay on people's records for the rest of their lives. Ryan Gabrielson and Topher Sanders are reporters for ProPublica who conducted this investigation, and they're with me now in the studio. Welcome to The Takeaway, guys.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
Topher, let me start with you. Just how widespread are these tests throughout the country? How often are they used?
They're super common, but the public doesn't really know about them. And so, you know, police use field tests in 10 out of 10 jurisdictions, according to a survey that was done by the federal government. So they're very common.
Ryan, how do they work?
Essentially, they're plastic pouches that have glass vials inside of them containing different chemicals. You drop in a little bit of the suspect material into the bottom, break the glass vials, and it pours the chemicals. They're called reagents on top of it. You flick the pouch until it starts causing a reaction, and you watch for the color. Depending on which test you're using, a certain color signals positive for one drug or another. No reaction, you know, typically means nothing, but different colors can also mean negative, which isn't always necessarily understood, too.
Now, in every research lab in the world, there's a difference between the bench science and the real world. So what are the problems with how these field tests are working in the real world? What's going wrong?
One of the biggest problems is that street drugs aren't one thing. You're not buying cocaine that's just cocaine. The other problem with it is that officers are doing it at night. They're doing it by the flashlight. They're doing it under pressure of about to make an arrest. And that can, you know, these are completely subjective tests. What color does the officer see when he's going through the procedures? And that is the only evidence that the field test was positive or negative is the officer said, this is what happens. And they don't very, very rarely understand the mechanism behind the color. They don't understand the chemistry. And so when it turns blue, they say, okay, it turns blue. It means cocaine. Well, blue can mean over 80 different things depending on the test.
Okay, that's fine. But I'm in a car. They drop in something from the back of my car. I go to jail. It's no problem. I just tell my lawyer, hey, these tests, they're not reliable. You're going to tell the judge this evidence stinks and they're going to let me go, right?
I wish it worked that way. You know, our reporting found that in city after city, the prosecutors and judges will take plea deals based just on the presumptive test, just based on this test that's done on the roadside. And so we're talking Atlanta, Boston, Chicago, Dallas, Jacksonville, all over the country, folks are having to take pleas or feeling compelled to take pleas based on the number of years they could subject themselves to by going to trial just based on this field test.
So what does this mean? This means that the vast majority of these cases never go to trial. You're sitting there in a cell and the lawyer says, you got to cut a deal because of this test, and this happens thousands of times over?
Yeah, more than 90% of convictions in this country come by guilty plea. They're through plea deals. And so, yeah, when you're sitting there in jail, if you can't bond out, and especially if you can't hire a private attorney, you're facing, you know, a long, you know, wait while sitting in a cell for a lab result for a trial.
So tell me, guys, what's the size of the universe here, given all of the number of people who are arrested in this way, given the number of false positives, which aren't even really knowable in the real world? How big is the universe of people who've pled guilty or gone to jail or to prison behind drug charges based on these tests?
We wish we could tell you. You know, there's really no way to tell you how many people have been wrongly convicted based on the field test. And that's mainly because of the dynamic that the story highlights about Houston, one of the few places we found that does post-plea testing. That means after you take your plea, they still test it in the lab. Most places, this is where it gets scary, most places take that plea deal and then destroy the evidence. So there's no way to know whether or not that plea deal was based on actual drugs that someone should take a felony for.
And now we'll never know.
And we won't know.
Ryan Gabrielson and Topher Sanders are reporters at ProPublica, reporting out a story on tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of guilty pleas for drug charges across this country based on scientifically unreliable field tests in jurisdictions all over America. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is on Anchor. If you have the Anchor app and search The Takeaway, it's a great way to reply to one of our questions or chats. And if you're starting a discussion that you'd like us to hear, use the tag The Takeaway. Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program. Performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com. And Staples, offering printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals. At Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. The Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act, that was one piece of legislation that seemed to have a good chance of passing Congress this session. But time is running out, and chances are getting slimmer and slimmer that anything will get done on criminal justice reform, certainly before the summer recess that's coming up. It might be a missed opportunity for the proponents of criminal justice reform, and also a missed opportunity for conservatives who've seen their ranks grow in favor of reforms on tough sentencing laws and incarceration. David DeGon is author of Prison Break: Why Conservatives Turned Against Mass Incarceration. He says the current embrace of prison reform is being led by conservatives like Newt Gingrich, who've been able to gradually convince other conservative peers that it's time for new thinking.
The genius of the conservative strategy was to link people's fear of rising crime to the anxieties that many white Americans felt about the decline of segregation, about the integration of neighborhoods, about school busing, about racial change. The notion that we could crack down on lawbreakers was linked very much to racial anxieties, in some cases, you might say, to racism, and it became a way to tap those fears. A big part of the story was that liberals were simply too weak to do the job.
So we're at a moment now, however, in politics where criminal justice reform is very much at the top of the agenda. And it's not just the liberals who want to have shorter sentences. There are traditional law and order Republicans, former law and order conservatives, sometimes self-described, libertarians, people from all over the right who seem to have had a change of heart about the advisability of mass incarceration. What's changed?
Crime is just less of a problem. It's still a major problem in the United States, but violent crime in particular is down significantly from where it was in the late 1980s and early 1990s. And it has registered with the public that the streets have become safer. That trend has opened up much more space for a discussion of alternative approaches than was available when people were just scared. The second major trend is a change within the conservative movement, and that is a shift toward the libertarian wing of conservatism. So they've gone from seeing law enforcement as the unquestionable defenders of civilization to being a bureaucracy, as they say in one of the cliches of this movement, just bureaucrats with guns.
And also budget crises where governments are strapped, and maybe if libertarians are on the rise and Republicans are wanting to cut costs, prisons are a great place to look.
Austerity has certainly given conservatives and liberals as well a prod to take a harder look at prison budgets. But there is a genuine ideological change occurring here. And in fact, some of the most important reforms that got this movement started happened before the recession of 2008, before the really biting era of austerity.
So we've talked about the ideological and we've talked about the practical, the budget cutting. What about the moral case? How has the moral perception of mass incarceration changed on the right?
It's changed substantially, and the credit for much of that goes to the evangelical wing of the movement. I think in part we can see the conservative turn on mass incarceration as the product of an alliance between evangelicals and libertarians. And the most important player in this was a guy named Charles Colson, who had unquestioned conservative credentials. He was, in fact, a hatchet man for Richard Nixon, ended up going to prison for his role in Watergate. But emerged a born-again Christian and dedicated the rest of his life to ministering to prison inmates. And over a period of decades, he won a tremendous amount of respect. And Colson really pushed evangelicals to start seeing prisoners as people, people who were fallen, people who could be redeemed, people who needed the help of those on the outside.
So David DeGon, let's talk about the politics of the moment for a second, because there is criminal justice reform legislation that's in play right now. It may get done this year. It may not. Either way, it's going to be limited. So looking forward for the next year or two or three, how durable is this change in conservatism that you're talking about? One can see a scenario where the pendulum starts to shift back.
I think it's helpful to think about that question by distinguishing between the state level of policymaking and politics and the national level. Conservatives in the last 10, 15 years have consolidated their control of many states, in particular in the South. Those are now bright red, solidly red states in which conservatives don't really get much utility out of attacking Democrats because they're in charge and are, in fact, responsible for the problems of governance. And it's in those states that you have seen rather aggressive movements to reduce the prison population. That's the good news. The bad news is that, as you point out, the national climate is shifting in ways that could give state politicians pause.
So do you buy the argument from advocates that this is the politically opportune moment for criminal justice reform, and if it doesn't happen this summer, the opportunity could slip away because Obama won't be president anymore and the conservatives could bolt? Do you buy that?
That argument has been made in order to push federal legislation, which has been more and more diluted as it's progressed through Congress. And advocates are still really hoping for a win on a federal bill that would reform the federal prison system. Now, it's worth noting, again, that 90% of prison inmates in the United States are held by the states, not by the federal government. So this is a bill that targets federal criminal justice operations. And advocates have indeed been arguing the window is closing. I don't know if I do buy that. I think, in fact, there's a risk that passing a bill now provides a very juicy target for Donald Trump and for critics like Senator Tom Cotton, who are very much in the spotlight at the moment, to attack the cause of criminal justice reform more broadly as the product of a left-right cartel in Washington. I think this might be a moment to take a break and give the states more time to work on this policy and let the conservative movement regroup. After the Trump moment passes, as it may, if he is not elected president.
The history of law and order conservatives and the transition to modern reformist conservatives in criminal justice reform. The book is Prison Break, Why Conservatives Turned Against Mass Incarceration. David Dagon, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we are talking ballot initiatives and the whirlwind of direct democracy later this hour. It raises a question. What issue should never appear on a ballot for you, the voter? From Deer Park, New York, civil rights issues like voting rights, districts, issues of race, class, or gender equality. You leave those topics to the people and the bigots show up in numbers. Remember Proposition 8.
My name is Amy. I'm calling from Bedford, Massachusetts, and I thought gay marriage should never have been put to a vote. It's a basic human right.
Can you be trusted as a voter with ballot initiatives, or should you leave it up to the elected officials to cool the saucer? 8778-MY-TAKE is the number. You can comment on our website at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, offering printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals. At Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
Well, here's a question. Can democracy be too much of a good thing when questions of taxes, drug policy, even gay marriage are put up for public votes? Is it a good idea to take the debates designed for those boring and procedural legislatures throughout the country and instead turn them loose on a passionate public? Can voters, in a word, be trusted? Well, James Madison didn't think so. He wrote in Federalist 10 that a representative government is the way to go. I'm paraphrasing here, but Madison warned that too many decisions left up to voters means passions and factions and dysfunction. Well, look at the UK just last month. Voters there elected to leave the EU, and now, in the aftermath, a lot of questions about whether Leave supporters fully understood the economic and political ramifications of their beloved Brexit. Well, in this country, there were 104 statewide ballot measures in 34 states as of July 4th. Marijuana, guns, health care, minimum wage are just a few of the notable issues left up to ballot measures. California is the nation's capital of ballot measures, and it's made it easier, not harder, to get questions and referenda on its ballots. We'll have more from California in just a second. But first, we turn to Wendy Underhill. She's program director at the National Conference of State Legislatures. Wendy, welcome.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, as I described, James Madison thought in general that this was an awful idea. So how have these ballot measures spread so much throughout the country?
Well, since you're starting with history, I will too. The ballot measures, the citizens' initiative process is an artifact of the progressive era in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. And many of the states that were brought into the Union at that point actually put in their original constitutions that the citizens would have a way to bypass the legislature and vote for themselves on policy issues. So we've got history behind us on this side too.
And what does that history look like in reality? Did things that are put up for ballot questions generally stand the test of time? Do courts wind up overturning them? Are people happy with the results, or do they sort of get a hangover headache after being so darn democratic?
Can I answer to yes to all of the above? It really depends on what the measure is, and it depends on how well it was crafted and whether it was sort of just for that time or could stand the test of time. What I can tell you is that the number of ballot measures has been highest in the 1990s and has dropped just a little bit now. I think we're going to be seeing probably between 140 and 160 measures by the time the last of them are verified and put on those statewide ballots.
What does this reflect, a love of direct democracy or a disaffection with dysfunctional government? Forget you, senators, we'll do it ourselves.
I think it's the DIY, the do-it-yourself mentality. And if you've got an issue that you care a lot about and the legislature isn't moving forward on it for whatever that reason might be, and if you've got a walk around, you're going to take it. And gun control might be an example of that.
So voters or special interest groups are frustrated that other special interest groups are dominating the legislature, so they go right to the people and get it done like that.
Yeah, in the states where they can, and there's 24 states where citizens can gather these signatures and present their own measures. And absolutely, it's when they don't get what they want through the legislative process, then they'll try it out this way.
You know, there can be a downside here too, Wendy Underhill. Some states have used ballot measures to get, let's say, medical marijuana, which the voters wanted. And people who work at places like the FDA go crazy and say, oh, no, you don't approve drugs through popular vote. We have a system for testing and approving drugs that tries to keep people safe, and it's not one that involves going to the ballot box.
Well, you're absolutely right. It's an imperfect system, that's for sure. For one thing, it's just a yes or a no for the voter. They can't find a compromise, they can't adjust it, and if it's poorly written or poorly designed, that's what they get to vote on, and then that's what goes into the law books or even into the Constitution.
So, Wendy, we're going to talk about California in just a minute, which this time around, this election season, has two full pages of ballot initiatives for California voters. I know myself, I pay attention on the first two or three, but then when you get in the middle of the pack, 17 through 28, are people really reading these and making great decisions?
Well, one thing I want to say is from the local election administrator's perspective, having those long ballots costs them more because they have to print longer ballots and go to second and third pages. But from the voter's perspective, political scientists can show that voters are like you. They'll do the top one or two and then probably skip and catch the bottom one. And the other thing voters do is if they don't know, they vote no.
Wendy Underhill, program director at the National Conference of State Legislatures. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. It was good to be here.
Yay! No, yes.
Well, we got a brief history of ballot initiatives just a minute ago, so let's go to the American mecca of hot, passionate democracy now. Of course, it's California. California is leading the pack with 17 measures approved for its ballot this November. Lower signature requirements mean it's now easier to get your ballot initiative up and running than ever before. And that's made this November the most crowded ballot in California since the year 2000, when voters there had to decide on 20 different initiatives. Here to help us understand what all of these measures are on California's ballot and who's behind them is Marie Salago. She's California government and politics reporter for KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Marisa, welcome to The Takeaway.
Great to be here.
Great to have you. The California ballot is chock full of grassroots democratic energy from voters or special interest groups putting up the money to get the signatures and advertise to get their way. Which is it?
I'd say a little of both, with an added side of politicians looking to raise their profiles. We have, you know, as you said, 17 measures. And while, as you mentioned, the signature count was lower this year than it has been in previous years, you still needed 365,000 or so signatures to get something on the ballot unless you went through the legislature. And that takes money, right? So it's not as if just any old person could go out and do this without some backing of big money of their own or another group.
Not only that, to get the signatures, you're not going to win unless you can put up the money to get on television and get people to vote your way.
Oh, yeah. I haven't even gotten to that part.
Right. There's some pretty juicy initiatives on the ballot coming up. What are some of the big ones?
Yeah, you know, we're kind of trying to cover a little of everything this year. We got taxes, we got marijuana, we got guns. So I'll start, you know, I think marijuana is one of the biggest ones that's being watched nationally. And a lot of these, we have some star power behind it. Sean Parker, the sort of tech Napster founder and former Facebook executive, has promised to back this measure. This would legalize marijuana for adult use in California. It comes about 6 or 7 years after California voters voted down legalization. And so that'll be really closely watched. I think another one that everybody has their eyes on is a gun control measure that's being sponsored by the Lieutenant Governor, Gavin Newsom, who's already announced he's running for governor in 2018. And so, you know, there's a lot here that's timely in terms of the national gun control debate. This would actually expand background checks to ammunition sales, not just gun sales, require folks to report when a firearm has been lost or stolen, and outlaw the possession of some large capacity magazines. What's interesting is the legislature just passed a lot of these measures and they were signed by the governor. So there is some repeat here and there's some kind of behind the scenes political jockeying going on among Democrats.
And it also sounds like a very important political stepping stool for Gavin Newsom, the former mayor of San Francisco, in his effort to become governor. I mean, he's obviously got a huge stake in this.
Well, exactly. And I mean, the president pro tem of the Senate here in California, Kevin DeLeon, has sort of publicly called on Newsom to back off this measure, saying, hey, we did this legislatively. There's no reason to run this campaign. I think what Newsom would say is, well, you know, if the legislature changed something, they could undo it. So we want the voters to put this into the law sort of permanently. Yeah, on the other side, this is a huge way to raise his profile, to raise a lot of money in advance of 2018. And I think he wants the credit, quite frankly.
Right, so marijuana and guns, those are exciting issues. Big taxes on the ballot. California voters are going to have to decide some important porn issues as well?
Yeah, there's actually a measure that would require condoms in pornography. And what's interesting is that there's actually a lot of pushback on this. There's some feelings that this could sort of cause the industry to go underground and really have a health effects to negative health effects on porn actors. So I do think we'll be hearing about that, probably not as some of these other measures, but it will be a talker for sure.
There is an issue of the ballot measure, though. I mean, this is alarmingly reductive. There are relatively few people involved in the porn industry in California, even though it's worth billions. You're asking, you know, 15 or 20 million Californians to make a decision about a pretty narrow slice of an industry that's located in part of their state.
Yeah, and I think that gets to the issue you were talking about earlier, which is, you know, is this always the best way for democracy to happen? Should, you know, voters put their trust in the legislators that they elect, or should we decide every little issue? And in California, we tend to take a lot of things to the ballot. I know where I live in San Francisco, you add on top of that a dozen or more local measures. And there's a real danger of that voter fatigue you mentioned. And just the fact that even if people do vote yes or no, they don't really know enough about what they're voting for to make as informed of a decision as they might.
And everyone in California certainly is going to have an important opinion on condoms in the porn industry. But there have to be some multi-billion dollar issues under the radar here in the middle of this 17 deep list of ballot initiatives. It's really going to make a difference to Californians, right?
Yeah, I mean, one that I'm watching really closely is a measure that would require a lease revenue bonds to go to voters anytime the state wants to issue them for projects over $2 billion. And you're probably going, what the heck does that mean? So essentially, when we fund infrastructure projects, a lot of times there are bonds taken out on future lease payments of those infrastructure projects. So we're talking about roads and highways and bridges. This is kind of an attack on a plan to build some twin tunnels in Northern California. It's part of California's decades-long water debate. And Governor Jerry Brown has made these twin tunnels kind of part of his legacy. And farmers in the Delta hate it. And so this is a way to head off that, but it has much broader implications. And so I do think we're going to see some big money spent on that. There's a prescription drug cap being proposed that the pharmaceutical industry has already put more than $50 million into a campaign to oppose. So that's one that's not necessarily as sexy, but I think voters are going to hear a ton about in the coming months.
And California voters also have to be thinking about Proposition 8 from 2008, which they passed to outlaw gay marriage in their state, only to see it overturned by the Supreme Court and the will of those voters completely undone. So just because millions of California voters go to the ballot box on these ballot initiatives, Marisa Lagos, doesn't mean they always stick, right?
That is true. And often we see voters being asked to undo something they just did. So it's kind of never ending.
Marisa Lagos, California government and politics reporter for KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
So we've been asking you what issues should never appear on a proposition ballot. From Alpharetta, Georgia, I hardly ever see issues on the ballot, especially important ones like TPP. I think we need more issues on the ballot, and we need them written and reviewed by independent parties who will be clear on what the vote is instead of using doublespeak to drive voters in specific ways. Give us your vote. 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. You can comment on our website at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ or Curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at Curious.com/PRI.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Pack up the kids, put them in the minivan or the station wagon, take a drive 40, 50 miles south of Cincinnati into northern Kentucky. And starting today, if you visit the tiny town of Williamstown, Kentucky, you'll have the chance to take the kids and visit Ark Encounter. And what you're going to find at Ark Encounter is a 7-story high, 500-foot-long replica of Noah's Ark that someone took the time to build to the exact dimensions described in Genesis when Noah and his family, including his son Ham, packed up two of every animal on Earth to protect them from the wrath of a very angry God. Ken Ham, no relation to the biblical son of Noah, or wait, is he? Spent $100 million on this project. You may have seen Ken Ham in the documentary film Bill Maher's Religious. He's also the founder of the nearby Creation Museum in Kentucky, where scientifically valid mock-ups depict humans frolicking with dinosaurs, thus proving, of course, that Genesis is not a myth, it's history.
Our goal is that people would come here and say, you know, I never realized Noah's Ark was so big. Wow, they answered questions like how you could fit the animals in the ark and how you could feed them and look after them. And really there's a word, feasibility. What we want to show people is this is feasible because we believe it actually happened.
Well, Ken Ham has also made some money through his company called Answers in Genesis out of exercising his First Amendment right to religious expression, and that's great. But here's the catch. Answers in Genesis got lots and lots of government tax breaks from the people of Kentucky. And after it got those, it fought hard for a religious test for whom it hires. And that has another First Amendment problem written all over it. Sherry Lawson is a reporter and local host for All Things Considered at WEKU in Richmond and Lexington in Kentucky. She's been covering the Ark and the community around it. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, Todd.
Well, I tried to describe the biblical dimensions of Ken Ham's Ark, but that doesn't do it justice. What does this thing look like?
It is massive. Picture a child's book with Noah's Ark, or maybe the movie Evan Almighty. It's a huge, massive, giant boat, a crude-looking wooden boat sitting in the middle of a field. It's really been crafted very well by Amish craftsmen, and it's enormous. It's a massive structure. It was built 15 feet off the ground. It stands about 510 feet long, 85 feet wide, and 51 feet high. It is truly massive, sitting in the middle of a field.
So Ken Ham wants us and our kids to traipse through the Ark and understand that it was feasible and that the Genesis story really happened the way the Bible says it does. And that's great. But I mentioned the problem here that this $100 million religious story has a lot of tax breaks behind it.
Here's the thing about that. The state promised the Ark Encounter a rebate of sales tax that could amount to as much as $18.5 million. Well, the state revoked the sales tax because of a statement of faith, because they realized that only Christians could be hired. Answers in Genesis took it to court and they won, and they called it a victory for religious freedom.
Surely it's a victory for religious freedom on some level, but how does an organization that says we're only going to hire Christians turn around and get concessions from the taxpayers of Kentucky?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I only know that the judge ruled in favor of Ken Ham, and that the new governor, Matt Bevin, is not going to appeal that decision. So Ken Ham is a young earth creationist, and he makes no apologies for that. He believes the book of Genesis literally. He believes the earth is 6,000 years old and that dinosaurs roamed the earth with humans. Well, Pastor Bob Fox is a Baptist minister. He's not a creationist, and he's fine with the Ark Encounter. He's fine if somebody wants to have a Bible-based theme park and encourage people to believe in the Bible, but he's not fine with the tax breaks because it violates the separation of church and state. It's a church and state issue. Pastor Bob Fox thinks it's really not okay.
The Ark Encounter is a ministry, and I feel like that they can do what they want with their ministry and with their ministerial dollars. I have a real problem when the government begins to support one religious expression over another.
So the people around Williamstown in northern Kentucky there who are watching all the tourists visit the Noah's Ark, I mean, do they suspect that Ken Ham is giving history and science lessons, or do they suspect that he's giving religious studies lessons?
I talked with many people in Williamstown. Many of the people I spoke with are extremely supportive. They can't wait. They can't wait for the Ark to happen on several levels. One, people believe some of the things that Ken Ham believes. They do think he's teaching a literal interpretation of the Bible, and they're okay with that. However, there are other people who are not okay with that. I talked with a couple of those people, but they would not go on tape. People in Williamstown who told me, you know, what's going to happen after 40 days and 40 nights, or I think this is absurd, they wouldn't go on tape because Williamstown is a tight-knit community, and they're afraid of repercussions if they speak against the Ark.
They feel like they're facing some social pressure there.
Exactly. The town is small, and there are a lot of empty storefronts. They're looking for a makeover. They want to revitalize the town, and a woman named Cindy Pelkey, she's 60 years old. She's lived in Grant County, Kentucky all of her life. She grew up in the area. She remembers when the town was vital. She, just a few months ago, put a new business in called Simple Pleasures. It's a gift shop. She hand makes everything in the shop. She is really counting on the Ark Encounter to buoy her business, as it were. I mean, she's really counting on the Ark.
I think it's finally going to bring some money into the county. It's going to get Williamstown back up and running. Williamstown almost become a ghost town.
Well, Sherry, I know we're talking about the Old Testament here, but is there a chance that Ark Encounter could resurrect Williamstown?
A good question. I know that the mayor believes that. I mean, the mayor told me that he has partnered with the Ark Encounter. He's completely supportive of it. He did admit he admitted that no hotels have gone up, no big restaurants. Now, having said that, the Ark has a 1,500 seat restaurant, a standalone restaurant at the Ark. But I think the mayor and other townspeople were hoping to see hotels and restaurants going up around the area. That has not happened. He said they've been talking with people who indicated, well, let's see if there really is a flood of tourists.
Well, the small businesses around Williamstown, Kentucky are popping up two by two. Will the flood of tourists come and support Ken Ham's Ark experience? The taxpayers sure have supported it. Let's see if tourists do too. Sherry Lawson is reporter and local host of All Things Considered at WEKU in Richmond and Lexington in Kentucky. Thanks, Sherry.
Thanks so much, Todd.
And here's something to take with you today. Marvel Comics is getting a new female Iron Man, a black teenager. Her name is Riri Williams. She'll be stepping into the role of Iron Man at the conclusion of this current Civil War II event. Her character is a genius who gained admission to MIT at 15 before building her own Iron Man suit in her dorm room. Look out, Tony Stark. Look out, Robert Downey Jr., right? You can ask me anything on Twitter, by the way, every day from Washington on Capitol Hill or even from the Takeaway Studios here in New York. I take your questions, often your complaints. I do my best to get back to you personally. If you're civil and you're making sense, you can tweet me your questions anytime at Todd Zwillick. Take the Takeaway with you. Also, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. We think it's a great way to stay up on the news. Again, you can find us on iTunes or any other service that you use to get your podcast fix. This is Todd Zwillick filling in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.